and welcome back to There Might Be Cupcakes. For those of you who are new listeners, welcome. And hi, I'm Carla. So glad you're joining me. I hope all of you have had a happy and peaceful holiday season. The podcast schedule for this year looks so promising, for good things are happening for me on my health front. I have new, strong additions to my health team, and my wonderful cardiologist is fighting really hard to make the quality of my day-to-day life a little better. Which means for me, more time to podcast, less vertigo, less fatigue, all that stuff. Hooray! I'm so excited. I did miss my planned Christmas horror and Victorian Christmas history episode because of my health, and I may do it anyway right after this one. In my faith, the Episcopal Church, the Christmas season only ended yesterday, January 6th, on Epiphany, and historical trivia and Victorian horror is welcome anytime, right? Right. Y'all are my people, you think like I do. And let me take this opportunity to thank you for always being patient with my health and therefore my low output compared to most other podcasts. You still stick with me, and I appreciate it more than you'll ever know. I love you, every single one of you. But for today, I am focusing on one of my major goals for this year. I am going to complete and publish my novel, Watching the Detectives. By the end of this year, one way or the other, this novel is going to be published and available for all to read. I've already read from it in two episodes, number 14 and number 28. Both are linked in the show notes through Smart Links. I'm going to read from it in this episode as well, new chapters. You do not necessarily need to stop listening to this episode and listen to those first. That's personal preference. I'm going to explain the premise here as well, so no worries. Watching the Detectives is named for the song by Elvis Costello, which is also linked in the show notes if you're interested in listening to it. I also linked the cover by Duran Duran, which is quite nice. My novel is about Beatrice Grace Burchett, a Virginia nursing student and cheerleader at an exclusive private college who went missing after a Halloween party on campus. Rumors fly, of course. She supposedly went off to the local Massanutten spa to pamper herself and make her parents and friends sweat. She ran away and changed her identity. She was kidnapped. Her car was found pretty quickly on a switchback on a mountain road on the way to Massanutten. The car's hazard lights were not engaged. The headlights were not on, and the car was locked. For those of you who do not live in a mountainous area like I do, a switchback is a set of curves that actually whips sharply back upon itself. Where I live, there's a switchback called the Devil's Backbone, if that gives you a hint. Switchbacks can be so intense that some of the curves can look like bobby pins from above. It is illegal to stop there, much less to park. Beatrice, known as BG, has a tight circle of friends, almost all in the Stith College cheerleading team, known as the Peers. The Peers have circled ranks, some out of fear, some perhaps because they know too much. One of them tells a reporter that the group is known as the Peers because, quote, they are peerless without peer. On that note, most of the kids come from Virginian horse country or around D.C., which is an old money area, where name, think the old meaning of the word peer, is beyond important. I've played upon that in the novel. You'll notice that in the first two episodes, the school is referred to as Tyler College, and now I'm calling it Stith College. It's because I'm using the first families of Virginia names list, and Stith is on it. Only a couple of very specific characters do not have surnames from that list, for very specific reasons. I'm reading two new chapters today. One is about Gwendolyn Harrison, aka Bendy Gwendy, the front stunt tumbler on the cheerleading team, who has been friends with Beatrice and her sister Priscilla since high school. It's her background story, how she ended up in the very special Stith College, the school the students call Fix You or Fix It You. As you'll hear some in her story, Stith is a college for the privileged to quote-unquote fix their kids, those kids that don't quite live up to that first family of Virginia name. The second is Alexandra Beverly's story, how she ended up at Stith College. Alexandra, who the Peers call X, as an ex-girlfriend and also is in the drug. Well, I see her as kind of the Greek chorus of the group, the person who can see more clearly the enmeshment and pathology of the friend group, perhaps because of her mood disorder, perhaps because of what she's been through. She's caught up in it all, no mistake, but she definitely sees something is wrong with how these kids operate. As much as she really wants to belong, and as much as she cares about her friends, she sees through all of it. I read about one example of her balking at the Peers machine in a previous episode. I'm going to start this episode with an updated version of a chapter I've already read. The explanation of what BG, Beatrice Grace, did to get expelled from UVA, the University of Virginia, and placed at Stith College. I think it'll give new listeners a really good look at the world of watching the detectives. I hope you enjoy this peek into my growing novel. I love these deeply flawed young adults, and I have empathy for every single one of them, despite some of the very disturbing things they do and have done. Peter, Alexandra, Gwendolyn, Catherine, Priscilla, Calvin, and Beatrice. I hope you enjoy the world I'm creating. Again, check out the links in the show notes to the other two episodes, also to the songs quoted in this episode, and to my playlist on Apple Music that I listen to when I write. The playlist image, which is how I imagine the campus of Stith College, is an aerial photo of my neighbor, Sweetbriar College. Who's going to tell you when it's too late? Who's going to tell you things aren't so great? You can't go on thinking nothing's wrong. Who's going to drive you home tonight? Drive the cars. Every privileged, smart, rich, white girl from the best families and the best gated communities and with the best connections has a battle plan. She has this battle plan before she's old enough to know what one is, to know that she needs one, and certainly old enough to understand that she will have no hand in forming her own battle plan. What might be included in this battle plan? It depends upon where this girl lives. Definitely emboldened bullet points for major rites of good girl passage. Baptism, purity balls, confirmations and bat mitzvahs, daddy-daughter dances, homecoming courts, proms, debutante balls or cotillions, first country club mixers with the right sort of boys, their very own membership to the country club, the right sort of first car, appearance is everything. Admission to the right college with just the right career path. And never fear about that left-hand ring finger. Daddy and mommy will lock that shit up. They know what's best for baby girl and who is best. They have had fine ideas about what they want their daughter's last name to be, maybe since she was born, and they have most probably been working towards that goal over hands of bridge and highballs and handsy slow dances at the country club with other women's husbands and other men's wives. First, she might have a purity ring, earned at a very special daddy-daughter dance, where she promises that her only men will be Jesus and Daddy until they give her to her husband. Oh, baby girl has choices. Beatrice Grace had choices of what college to attend for undergrad. Daddy and Busy Bee had it all worked out. Her mother, Louisa, didn't need to worry about a thing, really hadn't been consulted much once Beatrice had found her voice, which had been early. Beatrice's plan included a well-heeled Southern school for undergrad, with an historical and political grounding, an esteemed D.C. alumna, University of Virginia, Georgetown, perhaps Chapel Hill or Duke, maybe Washington and Lee or the College of William and Mary, if she and Daddy were feeling avant-garde. Then definitely something near the center of power for grad school, most likely Georgetown. One branch of the master plan that had both Amos and Beatrice salivating was nursing undergrad at UVA. With training at the university hospital and a combination master's in public policy / juris doctor from Georgetown, she could be poised to be a policymaker for the CDC, the Surgeon General's office, any of a number of congressional committees. All that power smelled like pipe smoke, tweed, and old money. Beatrice was going to save lives and run shit, and she didn't know who was more turned on by that, her or Daddy. Martha, good, dutiful older sister and denizen of the D.C. Beltway, was roped into the recruitment and recommendation part of the plan. Martha Burchette Cotterill, due to her exceptionally strategic political marriage to a high-placed fat cat Washington attorney, was in the perfect place on the chessboard to present her shiny penny little sister and her need for recommendation letters for college and her master plan full of dreams. Because Amos and Beatrice had been so carefully cultivating Busy Bee's master plan, her name was already somewhat known. She was that pretty redhead at the country club balls, the daddy-daughter dances, the purity balls, prom queen. She sang the national anthem at that one event, right? Sure, I'll write her a letter for UVA. I'm UVA 64 myself, Jefferson School proud. So Amos and Beatrice applied to UVA, Washington and Lee, and Chapel Hill, saving Georgetown for grad school. Busy Bee got into Chapel Hill and the University of Virginia and chose UVA. UVA not only has a stellar nursing program, but is also surrounded by the Appalachian Mountains and sports an indoor bouldering wall. She could rock climb to her heart's content while studying anatomy and learning how to draw blood without blowing a vein. Heaven. And then. Beatrice might have well have ripped the master plan into small pieces and thrown it out her car window while driving down Highway 29, and thrown Amos's heart after it, though he never said so. He didn't have to. It was all hushed up, of course. Amos was privately, not publicly, humiliated. So there's that. And his busy bee made it up to him. Oh, yes, she did. Everything's gonna be all right, Daddy. And with the help of Timothy Graves, student legal representative, she finagled a deal with UVA. If she left quietly and never, ever used UVA on her resume or CV, never claimed allegiance nor relationship with President Jefferson's school, charges would not be pressed and events would not be made public. Out of respect to her father's reputation and high standing in Washington, D.C., and her sister's husband's as well, and to the generous donations to the school given by the Burchetts over lo these many years to the University of Virginia and other historical monuments in Central Virginia. A devoted, upstanding Virginian family with long-standing ties and demonstrated devotion to the state and its heritage. A misunderstanding. A series of misunderstandings. She hadn't meant any harm by using her dorm mate's credit card number to order takeout. She'd misunderstood. Complete misunderstanding. That student had said he would order food for the floor any time to, quote, hit him up. And he'd left his card out on his desk. Yes, that was a lot of pizza and takeout Chinese for one girl. Yes, Beatrice had a single dorm room, no roommate. No. Beatrice declined to discuss the logistics of the purchases made. She had made reparations to the student in question, and he had therefore declined to press charges. Misunderstandings. Shoplifting from the campus bookstore? No, Beatrice Burchett did not shoplift school supplies from the bookstore. Beatrice walked too close to the entrance of the bookstore holding some Sharpies and a notebook while talking on her cell phone and stepped outside to get better reception. Everyone knows there's poor reception in the bookstore. When an employee spoke to her, Beatrice remedied the situation. Yes, the store items were tucked under her arm. She was trying to balance her bag, those items, and her cell phone. Just a series of misunderstandings. Perhaps an ill fit with the nursing department. Indeed, an ill fit. It happens. Such things happen, and well, such errors should reflect poorly upon the admissions department and the nursing department, not the college student. They were the professionals. And besides, Beatrice was able to account for and return almost every single pill that she stole from the pharmacy. No true harm done. No victims here, considering she only took the pills for herself. As Representative Graves explained, she had no intention to sell or distribute, no intention to hurt anyone. Beatrice Grace Burchett is a good girl who is going to school to learn how to help and heal others. She didn't even truly realize she was doing wrong. She was overly fatigued from so many coursework and practicum hours. She couldn't expect to be held fully responsible for making good choices as a sleep-deprived 19-year-old brand-new nursing student. And where was the supervision? Beatrice should have never been left alone in the dispensary with all the drugs. And whose fault was that? Not Beatrice Grace's. Now really, isn't it best that none of this goes public? For everyone's sake. There's an avalanche coming. don't cover your eyes. It's what you thought you wanted. It's still a surprise. It's hard on the body. It's hard on the mind. To learn what kept us together, darling, is what kept us alive. Unbearably White, Vampire Weekend. Gwendy loved the semester's history requirement best of all. Sure, she was a straight-A BSN student. Throw any nursing class at her, and she would, did, and shall ace it. But she adored her electives, and this autumn semester was a history, and this class, ancient history, was her favorite place on campus. Even above her cozy little dorm room that she shared with X, even above cheerleading practice or cheering a game. That was a secret. A huge secret. A tell-no-one secret. Not because it was such a private fact, but because Gwendy knew no one who would understand or support her feelings. And she felt more comfortable upon the banks of the Euphrates River than with her closest friends, doing what was her, was it, her favorite thing. Was it really? She traced one perfectly manicured fingernail, short, per BG's rules. A long fingernail could either break way past the quick or poke a fellow cheerleader's eye out. Down the weathered cover of her paperback, Lysistrata. Her gel lacquer in the school color of royal blue, Go Stiff's Blue Bloods, dug itself into the groove of the Greek vase on the book's front cover. As she waited for the professor to begin, she wondered, would withholding sex really work to change a power differential? Could a group of women, or men for that matter, withhold their sexual favors and affections so long that the other would cave in and change their behavior? Or was the play merely a satire? She rested her chin on her arm, mesmerized by her fingernail's path, up and down the edge of the vase. Did she have anyone to ask? Rock, maybe, with all the strange things he read and his opinions on everything. But would he talk to her about it, eye to eye over a cup of tea or coffee? Or would he crow and laugh and broadcast her thoughts with the others as jokes, as the newest fun, the latest, newest, freshest romp? Was she the only one of her friends who wasn't obsessed with sex? She internally probed at herself, imagining a mini scuba diver checking out first her clitoris, then plunging through her cervix, crevice, to her ovaries and uterus, coming away with confusion. Sure, sex felt good, if she was drunk, or if she acquiesced to take one of X's ecstasy pills, which wasn't often. They made her feel squirrely and odd, scratchy inside her brain pan. But when she didn't have sex, she didn't want it. She knew, she thought she knew BG had sex with all, or almost all, of their mutual friends, sometimes together. She knew that there was plenty that went on while she was volunteering at the campus museum. That was okay. Her friends were wild in a way that she could never be, and they accepted that. She thought they did, and she did too. Did she? Maybe. She guessed she would continue to cheerlead, tumble in front of the team as Bendy Gwendy, dance with Rock and drag bars, and then get married to Mr. Wright. And then she would enjoy sex with a shiny diamond on her finger. Or not. Until then, she would enjoy her body as best she could, cheerleading and dancing. And she would relish the delicious immersion of her history classes. Stith's nursing program was set up like most Virginia schools were. Over 4 years, students were to earn 72 nursing credits and 48 general education credits. Those gen ed credits were split up between the natural sciences, maths, histories, and social sciences. Beyond that, electives were encouraged for further success beyond Stith. The more work a repentant fixed-U student did, and the better they did naturally, the more work Stith would put into their fix-it engine, helping that student clear the way and glad hand amongst the land of grown-ups. Gwendy's problem, one and only problem, as far as Stith and Mother were concerned, was addiction. She was such a good girl, and that was part of the problem. Gwendy lived to please her mother Abigail, an extremely prominent attorney in D.C. and Georgetown. Gwendy had attended a Tony private school for the children of politicians and celebrities. For a while. The day for uniform fittings was seared into Gwendy's mind and bone marrow. Her mother had called ahead for all the necessary outfit pieces in her sizes. Navy pants, kick pleat skirt, pencil skirt, designer sweatshirt, and cabled pullover sweater and cardigan. white uptown button-up shirt and long and short sleeves, white cabled pullover sweater and cardigan and polo, navy and white rugby jersey, navy and white phys ed outfit that looked like a girl's field hockey outfit out of a movie about a twee boarding school, and socks in both colors that were so precious that looked like they might squeal. Looking at the hyper-coordinated, carefully folded and carefully creased pile of hyper-coordinated, hyper-expensive clothing, 6-year-old Gwendolyn felt like she either might hurl or laugh. She had pinched her mouth tight, tight, tight to avoid either. Shoes, of course, are up to parental discretion. "We trust your judgment," the lady with the clipboard had been saying, and she definitely had looked like someone who had never trusted anyone else's judgment, ever. "Just closed toe and, well, nice. Appropriate for our school. You understand." 6-year-old Gwendolyn had known that meant expensive. She had stared at the back of the clipboard, waiting for this to be over in hopes that a visit to the country club pool might be in order. Mother had finished the big case, and whenever Mother finished a big case, she usually loosened up and took Gwendolyn to the country club. "Try them on, in this case." And suddenly Mother and the clipboard lady were looking at her.
"What?"
"Gwendolyn, don't be rude. Do as she asks, please." Gwendy had gaped.
"Asked what?"
Her mother looked pained and embarrassed. She leaned over and hissed in that "I don't want company to hear" voice.
"Please, Gwendolyn, she wants you to try your uniform on. She's afraid your size won't fit you because of your tummy."
And Gwendy had looked up at the clipboard, at the fluorescent lights gleam on the back of its metal clip, past the clipboard to the clipboard lady, and found that the clipboard lady was looking at her with sympathy? No. Sympathy and something else. Something she didn't recognize until adulthood as a little bit of disgust. And at that moment, when she dreamed about it later, she sunk down, down, down into the plush industrial carpeting and past it, disappearing into a dark void where disappointing little fat girls go. Gwendy had a little kid pot belly. A little Buddha belly, her now absent father had called it affectionately, until Mother had put the kibosh on that, and quickly. That plus always being a little taller than her classmates made her appear, to a certain type of person, to be a much larger child than she was. The school uniform, in the expected size, had fit, because that was the size clothing that she wore, naturally. But the damage was done, and oh, was it done. Had Gwendy been attending a normal school with rectangular industrial pizza cuts and corn off the cob and cardboard milk cartons and sporks, Gwendy might have had some breathing room after that "she might be fat" shaming event. But Gwendy's Tony school for Tony-toned kids had a dietitian and unfortunately encouraged dieting in the youngest of its students with its Tony-toned setup. And so Gwendy, young elementary school Gwendolyn Archer Harrison, dieted. She counted her food items. She arranged them by size and color. She fetishized her food. And in fourth grade, Gwendy learned about diet pills from Mother and Doctor. Gwendy loved the strange, silent buzz in her head when she first stole her mother's pills, then started taking her own when her doctor agreed that perhaps when Gwendy started her period in fifth grade, that Gwendy's young metabolism might need assistance to grow, to be shaped, pruned like a pretty shrub by the handsome gardener. She felt like she could hear the battery that operated her, hear her operating system churn. And she continued to count her food items, to line up her food items before she ate them. And now she ate them more slowly and ate less of them, and no one noticed. There were many disordered eaters at Tony Prep. No one noticed. No one cared. Everyone else had something else to worry about. Gwendy fit in. Until the buzz of her operating system became too loud for Gwendy to bear. Her hard drive ground on day and night, and she couldn't hear anything else. Hum, hum, hum. So she found other things to take. Wine was amazing. Wine dulled the hum and filled up her tummy and didn't make her brain and insides buzz loudly and was trendy to boot. She developed a taste for the deep reds, and amused herself more than once by letting it trickle out of the corners of her mouth while standing in front of her mother's lit and magnifying vanity. "Look, America's sweetheart is a vampire." And that was middle school. She was removed from Tony Prep in 8th grade when she mixed benzos that she had scored from Conrad Dandridge with an extremely expensive Merlot from Mother's collection and vomited deep, deep red all over her crisp white cabled sweater, navy penciled skirt, and twee white cabled knee socks while in geometry class. 8th grade Gwendolyn, who had given Conrad Dandridge a lotiony hand job, a rather expensive Tom Ford Eau de Wood moisturizer hand job, he'd pulled the matte black tube out of his bag. Even now, the smell of sandalwood or cardamom made her taste Merlot and bile in the back of her throat. Rubbing $90 lotion into his 8th grade dick behind the hall named for his grandfather for those benzos, she had vomited $100 Merlot all over herself and then had fainted headfirst into the corner of the geometry teacher's desk after being called to the front of the class to prove a theorem, making a stitches-worthy acute angle dent into her perfect skinny face. Her 8th grade school picture was her best-looking one. She'd looked like a model, like the Caucasian half of a United Colors of Benetton ad, pale and thin and worldly and hungry. Pre-stitches, thank God, Mother had said 10,000 times. Mother had framed that picture of her face and hung it over the mantel. Mother had sent her face to the best plastic surgeon in New York City, and that was middle school. In 9th grade, Gwendolyn and her mended face were sent to the best public schools in all of Virginia, D.C., and Maryland. She and Mother had moved especially to be in its district. In 9th grade, Gwendolyn and her mended face were sent to the best public school in all of Virginia, D.C., and Maryland. She and her mother had moved especially to be in its district and to move away from anyone who remembered Benzo Gwendo. It was the East Coast version of Beverly Hills High School, and every student had parents who were in government or were filming a movie or were old money or were some mix of the above. No more twee knee socks, but sometimes Gwendolyn would smell Tom Ford in the hallways and gag. She met Beatrice and Priscilla at cheerleading tryouts. All three of them made the team, and a girl on the team named Melissa Talaferro taught Gwendolyn to make herself vomit in order to make flyer weight. And Gwendolyn found that making herself vomit turned down the sound of her internal hard drive hum, 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 like nothing else did. Not wine, not benzos, not exercise. And vomiting made cheerleading team pizza parties possible. And fun. And best of all, she was not the tallest girl on the team, nor the heaviest. The bases were. Those strong girls that could hold and throw other girls in the air. Solid, strong girls. Sometimes Gwendolyn would watch them in practice and workouts and envy their muscles and sinews, their solidity. But then she would remember the flash of a clipboard in fluorescent light and the sinking feeling into industrial carpet. And she knew her body was not meant to look like that. And she would sneak down to Mother's wine cellar after late practice, hustling an expensive dark glass bottle, sloshing priceless darker liquid up to her room, wrapped in sour workout clothing, and would play a new game of vampire. And then Gwendolyn would lie on her bed, after drinking and after vomiting and after drinking more, the room spinning and her throat raw and her heart stone raw, and she would tumble without tumbling and wonder what weight her soul was. And that was 9th and 10th grade. The high school cheerleading team was a championship team, of course. They didn't always win the national championship, but they always went to Orlando. They were always on TV. In 11th grade, in Beatrice and Gwendolyn's 11th and Priscilla's 12th, she was still Beatrice then. She wasn't BG until she became a peer at Stith. Priscilla was captain, and they were favored to place in the top three going into the national competition, 4th in the nation. Gwendolyn, drunk and malnourished, wrecked a Mercedes golf cart at the Chichia Hotel that was hosting their team and fractured her wrist. Both mother and coach insisted she compete anyway. Mother because it was her fault, and she needed to accept the consequences of her actions, and she needed to stop embarrassing everyone. Coach Jennings because the alternative front tumbler, an alternatively frightened and hyped 10th grader named Spencer Warner, was not good enough, and Gwendolyn owed it to the team, and she knew how to play through the pain. Gwendolyn did know how to play through the pain. She did so with her wrist taped into place. They placed 4th, and then Gwendolyn had to have reconstructive surgery and a pin placed in her wrist to put the now broken bones back into place. Mother and Gwendolyn both lied to the incredulous doctor about a catastrophic car wreck that had shattered her wrist. Once it was repaired, it was back to the award-winning plastic surgeon.
You could only see the scars from a certain angle, when her skin was overly dry. It was a beautiful cover-up job, and that was 11th grade. And then Beatrice was squad captain. The team again made fourth of the nation. Gwendolyn continued to make all A's, was accepted into the very best schools for a girl who wanted an MRS degree from the very best sort of family, and stayed drunk and hungry and humming all the time. Her hard drive never turned off anymore. The vomiting didn't work, nor did the alcohol. She supposed that some would call it anxiety or perhaps a deeper mental illness, but she didn't understand how that was possible. Her room was spotless, so was her face. You could barely see the scar, especially when she used really good contouring makeup. Her grades were flawless, and she was a championship cheerleader. She went to parties all the time and dances as well. Her prom dress was a vintage Dior. She was a good girl. She loved both Hello Kitty and Louis Vuitton. Her mother was proud of her, so why was she terrified all the time? And then she did it. The it that switched up her plans from a four-year in humanities at Chapel Hill to a BSN in nursing at Stith Fix U. She humiliated Mother one too many times, and too publicly this time. It was after prom, the after party. She was at the country club, given over to the young wolves for the duration. Her high school, the Episcopal Day School, and the Allerton Prep Private School were all sharing it. So the buzzed privilege were roaming everywhere, all over the exquisitely manicured lawn, in every gorgeous plush room open to them, and even howling and mating on the golf course. Impossibly expensive shoes lay forgotten in corners like dead soldiers with empty glasses and plates. She was so nervous about her vintage Christian Dior prom dress. It was a special loan from a friend of her mother's, who owned a company that dressed the rich and famous, and rented clothing to movie companies for filming. It was the most luscious color of plum, and she felt like a rare piece of fruit in it, Tantalus's torture. Her dark hair was swept up and forced into an impossibility of braids upon braids, loops within draping loops, and pinned with a golden pearl orchid. She felt like she didn't look real. She felt unreal. She kept patting the folds of the dress and looking down her own plunging cleavage, expecting each time to find a rip or a fresh stain. She was already flying, not only on her own internal hum, but on adrenaline. She had stuffed herself on the buffet while her date was involved with chest bumping with the other guys, leaning way over to avoid getting anything on her dress. Oh God, oh please no. Scarfing little puff pastries and fancy tiny meat sandwiches made to look like rosettes. Sometimes eating fast, really fast, before anyone could see, felt better, so much better than vomiting. And whatever was in that wine punch, had she had 3 cups? No, 4, plus some muscle relaxers that one of her fellow cheerleaders had shared after pulling a hamstring. She was flying and full and standing out on the back lawn that overlooked the mountains, listening to music and the sounds of her fellow teenagers unsupervised, and the sounds of her internal hard drive slowing down, petting her dress and feeling like a good girl, and feeling lucky that her date, Stephen Fitzhugh, hadn't tried to have sex with her yet. She was supposed to want to, but she didn't want to. Not for any moral reason or any worry about messing her dress, but just for some ick feeling in the back of her now quite muddled mind. She remembered New Order was playing. She remembered that odd detail. The theme of senior prom had been something asinine about learning from the past. And so it was all Cameron Crowe and John Hughes soundtracks and stuff. So as the beginning horns and guitar riffs of Love Vigilantes rolled across the obscenely green, 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 green grass lawns of the country club, her feet went out from under her. Laughter. Both boy and girl laughter as she rolled in the grass, couldn't stop rolling, in her irreplaceable dress. Boy and girl laughter and her screaming, her enraged screaming. And then she was naked. She didn't remember getting naked, but she was raging at the small group that had knocked into her and the larger group that had gathered at the hullabaloo, and she was naked except for her Victoria's Secret thong that had been chosen to match the, oh God, the dress now ruined on the grass, fucking grass stains. Dior dress's deep plum. There you go! Is that what you wanted? She heard herself screeching, ruined! And she didn't know if she meant herself or the dress. And yes, she had removed it. Shimmied out of it in a cheerleading sidelines dance move, boobs, hips, legs, out. She squatted down and scrubbed the dress into the grass, and found there was already dew. Morning, a new day.
She rubbed her hands into the dampness and rubbed her now grubby, moist hands on her face, spoiling her expensive makeover. She stood and looked at her familiar and unfamiliar gathering crowd through raccoon eyes. This shit's supposed to be waterproof, and sticky bits of probably imported grass as the next song dropped, Head On by the Jesus and Mary Chain. Some kids had gleaned a better look at her smeared face than the deranged no-hold-bars expression on it, and her wild eyes, and stopped laughing. Some looked spooked. A couple of kids had even stepped backwards and begun looking around for imaginary beers, imaginary companions. Come on! She shrieked at their faces in the music. And the way I feel tonight, oh, I could die and I wouldn't mind. It's all ruined! It's over! Let loose, you fuckers! And she had first pogoed about on the manicured country club lawn, dancing frenetically to the music, slamming her goose-pimpled breasts and stomach into a couple of students in a line of fire, and stomping on the couture dress. Who cares anymore? And then she began tumbling right there on the exclusive lawn in the exclusive country club, nearly naked and buzzed out of her mind, as her exclusive peers hooted and cheered her on, and filmed her with their cell phones. At some point, they and she began chanting, Ruined! 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 As she flipped and tumbled and cheered. Mother and Gwendolyn, of course, had both immediately lost their country club memberships. Ruined. The next high school classes of the three high schools had not been invited to hold any more parties there. No thank you. Certainly you understand. Ruined. The country club had a long memory, and it did take time to grow and cultivate and care for such an expensive lawn. Award-winning lawn, you see. You understand. They understood. Mother has hired Stith College pre-admission committee crisis experts who had specific professionals, experts, who knew how to work with search engines to make results change for people who had been shamed online. Mother had, upon explaining, demanding, that Gwendolyn attend Stith instead of Chapel Hill, forced Gwendolyn to sit in front of Mother's own computer and search Mother's name, Mother's law firm's name, and to see Gwendolyn's video come up in the top search results again and again. Gwendolyn did so, completely sober, sobbing, with visions of sinking into the void beneath an industrial carpet in a hospital. Ruined. Mother had gone even farther, making Gwendolyn read the internet rumors, the Twitter posts and Instagram comments by people that lied and claimed that they were there and had seen Gwendolyn frenetically throw herself to the ground and yell school cheers while masturbating. That lied and claimed Gwendolyn had stripped down and danced as the beginning of a satanic ritual. Gwendolyn's perfect 8th grade school picture, which Mother had moved to her home office, stared reprovingly down at Gwendolyn the entire time. You used to be perfect, she said with her vacant eyes. Mother loves me, not you. Ruined. The next day, Mother and Gwendolyn had their first meeting with Stith College admission officials to fill out application forms. Gwendolyn was not surprised to find Priscilla there at Stith cheerleading tryouts. Relieved, but not surprised. There had always been something scary about Priscilla. Like Miss Pris would punch you if she felt she needed to, and that she often felt she needed to. Gwendy didn't know why Miss Priss was at Stith. They really had never discussed each other's stories. She was pretty sure Priss knew hers. Everyone had seen that video. Online and texted and Snapchatted and God knows whated of her. By the next day, most certainly everyone at her school and the two other schools involved in prom had seen it. Kids on the other side of the globe had seen it. Coach Jennings had called her at home and quietly and firmly asked her not to attend the remainder of practices or games. It's almost the end of the year. Let's just let this lie, Harrison. And that was that, after 4 years. And that was that of 12th grade. And that was that. That was high school. Gwendy snapped back from her ruined past as Professor Curtis entered the ancient history classroom with a flourish of books and papers and this strange whisper of noise that always seemed to follow him. Gwendolyn adored him, but in this unusual warm way she could never possibly share with him. His intellectual flourish and noise made her internal hum be quiet. She opened her history notebook and doodled her name inside the front cover and crossed it out. Not Gwendolyn. Gwendy. Bendy Gwendy. Gwendy has friends, real friends. Gwendolyn is fat and weird and bizarre and. Gwendolyn was ruined. Gwendy is a peer. Gwendy belongs. We've got to get you back to you. Get you back to you. Tori Amos, Reindeer King. Alexandra Beverly, the precious daughter of esteemed Congressman Beverly, RVA, and his award-winning physician, neurosurgeon, wife, was a lovely, willowy, dark girl. Dark hair, dark skin, dark eyes. Dark energy that coursed through her and caused her to bite and pick at the skin on her lips, her fingers, on scabs that never seemed to heal. The medication helped somewhat. Her parents and teachers called her high energy in school and in after-school prestigious extracurricular activities. Then they called her passionate. Then they called her nervous. Then they gave her medication to sleep and medication to get up for school in the mornings. Then they pulled her out of class when she wouldn't stop rocking in her seat. She said it was comforting and it wasn't anybody else's business. Then they pulled her out of class when she wouldn't stop crying. Then they pulled her out of class for throwing a pen at a girl who wouldn't stop staring at me. She just kept staring at me, so I told her to stop. I warned her. The pen nearly caught the girl in the eye. Then they pulled her out of school because she could no longer soothe herself. Whatever emotions she had full tilt-a-whirl until she ran its course. Intense and violent and storming, happy or upset, up or down or up or down. The hospital helped somewhat. Alexandra didn't like to take the medication the pediatrician, then the psychiatrist, then the hospital gave her. They made her tongue and her brain and her fingertips and toes feel fuzzy and disconnected. And she missed the highs. She missed riding an emotion from its surprising beginning to its very end, knowing the full stretch and length of it. She missed being awake and awake and awake. She missed the intensity of relationships when she was drugged. That's how she saw it. Drugged. Not medicated, not under a doctor's care. She didn't feel so intensely about her friends. She didn't want to stay on the phone for 3 hours with Courtney Payne after school, even though she'd just seen her. She didn't want to hang out on Kaitlyn Rolfe's neck like an item of clothing, like a pretty plaid blanket scarf just waiting to be paired with a perfect pumpkin spice latte. She just was. She just existed. She was just gray. She wasn't dark anymore. There were no internal firecrackers. No sparklers, no roller coaster, no chaos, no love, no hate. She didn't feel intensely about anything. Food had no taste. Sex had no oomph. She couldn't come on the new drugs, and when she found that out, she'd cut herself for the first time. To punish her parents and her doctors and her body and her malfunctioning brain, cut herself right across her upper thigh the entire length of her offending Mons. The hospital helped somewhat. Again. The psychiatrist said bipolar 2 very rapid cycling with a concurrent anxiety disorder. Possible impending bad things when she was an adult and the powers that be could lay more serious diagnoses on her. The hospital agreed, hinting around about the dreaded personality disorders. Her horrified parents naysayed loudly, Beverly's were not personality disordered. Her mother, the highly esteemed Dr. Beverly Sethi, stepped in and flexed her reputation and pulled some long strings and tied them into tidy bows around Alexandra's permanent record. And so Alexandra went home to her own disordered room and disordered mind and hid pills inside a hollowed-out copy of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince and stayed awake and stayed awake and stayed awake. Her parents found her stash of unswallowed medication. Because the one thing Alexandra did not have in her very full, privileged life was privacy, and removed the door from her room. Had the gardener removed the door from her room while she watched miserably from her bed, curled into a dissenting ball of Alexandra, and removed most of the belongings from her room. Had the maid removed most of the belongings from her room, stripping it down till it resembled her hospital rooms. Alexandra continued to pick and bite at herself, unable to cut anymore without access to the kitchen. The staff had been notified, but took her prescribed medication as directed. She then discovered ecstasy at school, thanks to Kaitlyn Rolfe, before Kaitlyn stopped talking to her. Kaitlyn had said she was spooky and clingy. What the fuck? Who says shit like that? She didn't understand. She just loved Kaitlyn and wanted to be around her all the time. Who doesn't want to be around their friends all they can every single minute? and the drugs mixed with her unusual brain chemistry and fought against the psychiatric medication, bringing the storms and the roller coasters back to an extent. And the sexual response, yes, finally, the sexual response, she could come again. But it felt different, with a sharp edge, like coming on the side of a knife, like a release, but not a nice one, an uneasy let go back into daily life. The first time she rolled, she stayed up 2 nights straight, playing Vampire Weekend on repeat and singing and strumming her guitar along with it until she lost her voice and her already gnawed fingers bled, refusing to eat or drink. The hospital helped somewhat again. Alexandra was able to focus on graduating high school with the intense help of a tutor. When left to her own devices, like an ordinary teenager who goes to school every day, she wandered, either in body or in mind. She had emotional outbursts in class. She didn't go to class. She had dramatic and loud breakups and makeups with boyfriends and friends, no matter the location. Obligations were forgotten or mistaken, and when remembered, Alexandra's response of remorse or embarrassment was intense. Her high school was concerned about her effect on other students' learning environments. To see Alexandra be still was to see Alexandra biting her lips or biting the skin on the edge of her fingernails or picking at either or at scabs or at imaginary scabs. Usually one or the other might be bleeding. Her psychiatrist worked with her to pick or twist at something that didn't injure her, the seam of her blue jeans, her necklace, her hair. Her nickname in high school, which became immortalized in the yearbook, was Fidget Spinner. Alexandra's boyfriend, the guy that had been dating her for a month or so, broke up with her the night of graduation at one of the many, many parties. She was, in his words, clingy, needy, desperate. He'd accused her, in front of an entire room of graduating seniors and drunken tag-along juniors, of not taking your meds. She wouldn't get off his lap. He didn't mean it. He wouldn't mean such things, truly. He was just drunk. But he did. He had outed her as bipolar to everyone. Crazy. And then had stood up, shoving her to the floor. She had landed in a mess of discarded cans of beer and Red Bull and Monster. She had instinctively grabbed onto one of his legs for stability, for everything in her vision wobbled. The cans, the walls, all of the legs. And he had laughed and shaken her off. "See, I told you you were a stage 5 clinger, crazy bitch." And the whole room had laughed and hooted. And Alexandra had hopped into his car, his dad's car, a new Beamer, too high on feelings and too high on adrenaline and too high on drugs to realize it wasn't her car, and too high on Alexandra to drive, and she had crashed it headfirst into the nearby sushi bar, doing as much financial damage to the sushi bar as to the car. Alexandra cannot remember anything from that night but cans on the floor and reaching for somebody, reaching and reaching and reaching, reaching for somebody who would not reach back. Thanks to a high-end safety system in the BMW and being loosey-goosey from drugs and drink and mania, she escaped with only concussion and whiplash. Her father's people agreed that she would not be safe in a normal, unsupervised college situation, that she could not be trusted to manage her own health, and that she was a future campaign risk. The hospital helped somewhat again. So did Stith College. Thank you again for listening. I'm going to start uploading episode scripts to Patreon, and I'll start with these three episodes so you can read them as well. Please stay tuned for a promo for Rebel Girls Book Club Podcast. Their latest episode is all about Little Women. Tune in for their review of the new movie version of the novel, starring Emma Watson and Florence Pugh. I have had a great deal of fun reading for my novel for you. I hope you've enjoyed listening, and I will continue to share with you as it develops. If you have any feedback or questions or encouragement, you can hit me up on Twitter or Facebook, or you can email me at Carla@ThereMightBeCupcakes.com. And I will see you soon.
Your regularly scheduled podcast programming.
And we're not sorry.
I'm Harmony.
And I'm Maggie.
And we're Rebel Girls Book Club.
We're here to take an intersectional feminist approach to books from all over the spectrum.
Bestsellers? We've got you covered.
That one book from English class you hated while you read but you can't forget?
We've got that too. Comic books, nonfiction, it's all right here.
So grab your tea, grab your blanket, and cue up your favorite podcast app of choice. Let's get rebellious about your new favorite reads.